Infamous Indy presents The Digging Up Dillinger Project, featuring the Texas Crime Travelers and Travis Thompson. I'm your host, Joe Malillo. In the annals of American crime, few figures loom as large as John Dillinger. A mastermind of bank heists, his name became synonymous with brazen robberies and daring escapes. Questions of whether he escaped an FBI ambush and the whereabouts of his buried loot persevere. History offers one account, but there are whispers that tell us many more. Join us as we go digging up Dillinger. Welcome to episode 2 of the Digging Up Dillinger podcast. I'm your host, Joe Malillo, and the team is back. Todd Hoss, Stuart Fillmore, Travis Thompson. Welcome back, guys. Episode 2. Here we go.
All right, let's do it.
So for our listeners, we told you this is Advanced Dillinger, but we really want to give you some 101. Please go back and listen to the full Infamous Indy episodes, Digging Up Dillinger on Infamous Indy. That's what it's called.
Part 1, 2, and 3.
Part 1, 2, and 3, right. So, and part 2 and 3 are with Travis and Mike as well. So let's go. I'm just going to read through and have everybody chime in with some if you find that the background information needs to be elaborated on or something that has to do with this developing history. That also, I do want to call out Travis for coming up, coining a phrase that I think is going to stick with us the entire time. He came up with it tonight, if it teaches you anything. He said it's called history breaking.
Yeah.
We're doing a history breaking podcast. Not ever do we really have a true crime, history true crime podcast that's developing. Like, this is what this is.
Yes.
You guys all doing okay before I just start going into this?
Hey, doing great, man. Yeah. Love it. Love being here.
Anything you want to say to the listeners before we get going? No. The answer is no. Silence. Okay.
Cheers.
All right, cheers. Yeah. Yeah. If you're watching, you'll see Stuart loves to drink a little tequila, maybe.
Got tequila going tonight. Maybe bourbon next time, but, you know, hey.
You'll understand why. With all the crazy roadblocks that we've had to go through. It's kind of a sensitive subject.
This is the background. It's a little bit 101. So John Dillinger was born June 22nd, 1903 in Indianapolis to a middle-class grocer. He actually had multiple grocery stores. Correct, Stuart? John Dillinger's father?
That, you know, I'm not really sure about that, Joe. I know there was one. I know there was one main store, possibly more than that.
John Sr.'s brother had an identical store not too far from the other one. So him there and his go. Brother were both grocers.
Interesting. Okay, so, and you say middle class, meaning somewhat wealthy. His mother, John Dillinger's mother, died when he was 3 years old, his biological mother, and he had an older sister named Audrey with whom he was very close, and his father remarried when John was 9.
Yep.
John was basically a rascal, good-natured by all accounts, but restless and prone to petty thefts. A story that stands out for me for the last from the Digging Up Dillinger special that I did on Infamous Indy is that it was easy to get booted off to or sent off to reform school, and he didn't get sent there. So,
yeah.
You know, how bad of a kid was he really?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, we're all rascals. I mean, I definitely got caught doing stuff I shouldn't been doing, but, you know, was he the John Dillinger back then that he turned out to be? We don't think so. His father moved to a farm in Mooresville to get John away from the city and what the father considered a bad element. John was still restless and joined the Navy to avoid car theft charge. That is such a good story, too. He literally steals a car, drops it off in the Circle in Indianapolis. If you know anything about Indianapolis, Indiana, the Circle is like where the monument is in the middle of the city. And he like drives from Mooresville with this stolen car and he drops it off. And then a police officer finds him. Grabs him by the collar, essentially, goes to call him in, and he takes off running, and he hides in a barn overnight. And what's interesting is, like, he comes up with the idea to go into the Navy during this situation. Like, he's like, that's the best I can come up with.
And wasn't the whole idea to steal a car to meet a girl?
I think it was to impress a girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, like impress that. A girl. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, you know, we've all had thoughts probably just as stupid. So hard, it's hard to fault him on that one.
No, right. Yeah. And how old was he then? Probably like 15, 16, 17? Or 19?
No, a little older than that.
Yeah, to get in the Navy, he'd be a little bit older.
Yeah, I'd say 18 or 19.
Got it.
Because he was around 18 when they moved to Mooresville.
A few months after serving on the USS Utah, which was at Pearl Harbor, wasn't it?
Which is at Pearl Harbor, yep.
Dillinger deserted and returned to Mooresville, where he married Beryl Hovis. Hovius.
Yeah.
I've never seen it spelled out. So Hovius. He also dishonorably discharged, right?
Yeah, I think later on, I forget. I think that was a few years later for some reason, but I could be wrong about that.
That's okay.
But ultimately, yes, it was a dishonorable discharge.
Like he was in Boston and jumped ship.
Yeah.
Yeah, he went AWOL.
AWOL. Got it. Dillinger was a very good baseball player, and some said he could have even gone pro. But while playing on a local team, a teammate named Ed Singleton talked him into robbing a local grocer named Frank Morgan, and Ed was his cousin, right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. He was his cousin.
Dillinger attacked Morgan with a steel bolt wrapped in a cloth, but Morgan yelled for help, and the robbery was bungled.
Yeah.
Botched.
It went wrong. It went south.
Nothing was stolen.
Frank Morgan was a big man, so it would have been a fight.
Dillinger's father talked with the county prosecutor, who convinced him to have Dillinger plead guilty without the benefit of a lawyer. The judge then sentenced Dillinger to 10 to 20 years in prison. Singleton received a much lighter sentence. Yeah, this was really one of the first kind of like big time things that Dillinger was like, screw the system.
Yeah, this really is kind of the defining moment, I think, where Dillinger... I think he held a bitterness about this the rest of his life, that, you know, Singleton, this was Singleton's plot, you know, to rob Morgan. And, you know, Singleton gets off relatively easy compared to Dillinger. And, you know,
it was an election year.
Who knows exactly why the judge was so harsh on him, but nonetheless he was, and you know, he was still a young man, and the best years of his life are spent in the penitentiary.
Terrible. And he was also the judge's name was Joseph Williams. So I love saying that because that's my middle name is William. And so my first name is Joseph. And Stuart and I always talk about it, that this is a case where weird things like that are connecting us to history.
So we
got to mention
a few more as we go along. But yes, absolutely. There's all these little weird little twists and turns that it's just hard to deny that there's some purpose to this thing we're on.
Yep. Dillinger spent the next 9 years in prison. It was here that he met and befriended several men who taught him the art of bank robbery. Real quick, the art of bank robbery. Who was the architect they call? And then
so
wasn't Harry, there was, Harry Pierpont was like a student and that taught Dillinger?
No. So Pierpont was one of the guys that he met and befriended in prison. But Pierpont and several others had studied the techniques of a bank robber named Baron Lamb.
That's it, Baron Lamb.
Yeah. Yeah, who essentially carried out bank robberies as a military operation. The bank was studied, surveilled, days or weeks ahead of time. An exit route was determined. Each person involved in the bank robbery had a specific job and a duty to do. It was timed out. It was planned down to the minute. And then
they made sure getaway cars had gas in them and things.
Exactly. They
aired up tires.
Aired up tires. They, like Todd said, they stored gas in cans hidden out on part of the route where they were going. It was very well planned and carried out like a military operation. And so these are the people that Dillinger met in prison. It was like it was bank robbery 101.
And not to mention they got plenty of time to learn it. So John just young and being like, you know, really really ambitious, right? So mm-hmm. And even so, his criminal career, right? So he went to jail. It says he went there for 9 years, you know, on a 10-year to 20-year sentence. So he obviously got out a year early after his family and friends came forth and petitioned, including the judge, including an old pastor. I think wasn't his pastor named Fillmore of some sort?
Yes. Yeah. And his pastor's name was Fillmore. And he actually not only sought to get John released, you know, on parole, but also ended up preaching his eulogy at his funeral.
Blows my mind.
Any relation to him?
Yeah, you got any relations, sir?
Not that I know. He was also a songwriter and wrote like an unbelievable number of church hymns. So
you raise me up. No, I'm just.
I've never written a song, so that may not, you know, no connection probably.
We go into his criminal career a little bit. Dillinger was paroled in 1933, and fairly shortly after his release, he robbed a bank in Bluffton, Ohio, and then he helped several of his friends break out of the Indiana Penitentiary at Michigan City. They formed a gang consisting of Harry Pierpont, John Hamilton, Charles Mackley, and Russell Clark. Yeah. They were all very successful. Several bank robberies, and Dillinger gained notoriety for jumping over bank counters and being very polite during the robberies. During this time, Dillinger was protected by an East Chicago, Indiana police officer named Martin Zarkovich. Zarkovich had a girlfriend named Anna Sage.
I'm not sure.
I thought it was Anna Sage.
Well,
it's like her real name.
You're giving it away there, Joe. Anna Sage's real name was Anna Campanis. I may have the pronunciation wrong. She was an illegal Romanian citizen that had been living in East Chicago for many, many years and ran a brothel there. She was the girlfriend and informant of Martin Zarkovich, the East Chicago, Indiana police officer that in the early days of the Dillinger gang gave protection to the gang and to Dillinger personally, and will later play a part in actually the takedown of Dillinger at the Biograph Theater.
And Zarkovich is going to be a very interesting name for our history breaking podcast, our developing history podcast.
Yeah, I think ultimately when we get into talking about the imposter theory, and you know, was it actually Dillinger killed at the Biograph Theater? Zarkovich is going to be a key player in this, as far as maybe did it happen or not happen. He's really key to this.
We also, I really love that you put in he jumps over the bank counters and he's very polite, right? Like,
yeah,
I think that's ultimately what, you know, we have a soft spot for our bad guys, but he was like nice bad guy. He was really a standout guy, giving tickets, movie tickets to kids, you know, in line, like saying to older guys, like, I think there's a story of somebody pulled out their money to give to him. And he's like, I'm not here for your money. I'm here for the bank's money.
Yeah.
And that was, you know,
he did it several times.
He burned mortgages. Then he like take and burn mortgages. Like, that's so cool.
Especially mortgages of farmers.
Oh, I wonder why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that I'm glad you put that in there, Stuart. After a vacation to Daytona Beach, Florida during Christmas 1933, Dillinger, when did Dillinger get out in 1933? What month?
He got out of prison in May of 33. Okay. The first bank robbery was in June or so. He gets arrested in September of 33 in Dayton, Ohio. And Clark and Makeley break him out of a jail in New Lima. And for those folks in Ohio, I may have that pronunciation wrong. I think it may be New Lima. I'm not sure, but please forgive me. But
just comment on our TikTok and let us know.
Exactly. Tell me how stupid I am not being able to pronounce it. But anyway, in the course of this breaking Dillinger out of this jail in Ohio, a sheriff is killed by Pierpont for absolutely no reason. It was really inexcusable. They didn't have to kill this man.
You mean William O'Malley?
No, this is before O'Malley. This was a sheriff named Jess Sarber.
Okay.
And again, it was just completely unnecessary to kill him. But nonetheless, they did, or Pierpont did. And but anyway, so Dillinger is, you know, he's broken out of jail this first time in Ohio. The gang then just is on a series of just wildly successful bank robberies from there. And then this you get to December of 33.
Hey, before you get there, let me just add this.
Yeah.
The day that they break him out of that jail, that's the same day that Machine Gun Kelly is convicted for kidnapping in Oklahoma City.
Ah, okay.
And that's,
all right.
That's the first.
Okay.
That's interesting.
A lot of people say that's the first major case that the FBI solved.
Well, it also actually, you know, there's some controversy to it, but, you know, there's some tales out there that it was Machine Gun Kelly that actually coined the term G-Man. Don't right. shoot G-Man. Don't shoot G-Man.
And what does G-Man mean?
Well, so if you see the 73 Dillinger movie with Warren Oates, that scene is in there. Machine Gun Kelly was arrested in Memphis, Tennessee in September of 33, which that's about right, Todd, that time frame. And in the movie, at least, you see Machine Gun Kelly's in bed with his girlfriend, and Purvis walks in and breaks into the hotel room, just sprays the room with machine gun fire. And Machine Gun Kelly's on his knees going, "Don't shoot G-Man, don't shoot G-Man." And then Purvis just knocks him in the head with the butt of the machine gun. And he goes, "You know, I like that G-Man. That sounds good. Government man." So, again, I think G-Man was really probably a public relations term dreamed up by probably, if not J. Edgar Hoover himself, somebody close to Hoover in the FBI. And through their friends in the media, they just made G-Man kind of a term. And again, it's one of those things that just sounds cool, you know, and so they attributed it to this successful arrest of Machine Gun Kelly.
Do you think he actually coined that phrase?
I don't think
just
so.
For them, it's just Hollywood again.
I think it's a I think it's a Hollywood thing. Yeah, I did.
I think we should do it.
I do think that movie's about.
I do think we need to do an episode about what the movies about John Dillinger got right and wrong. I think
that would be great. Oh, that would be great. Yeah,
I think that's something that I would really like, because I think a lot, at least the last couple of weeks when I'm bringing this up, if people. There's a couple of rumors or things that people know about John Dillinger, but a lot of that stuff is from the movies. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, so let's keep going. In Florida, Christmas, 1933, Dillinger and Hamilton return to Chicago, where they robbed the First National Bank of East Chicago. During this robbery, police officer William O'Malley was killed. Dillinger was charged with the murder. The gang then traveled to Tucson. Wait, hold on. So he was charged with William O'Malley's murder, but we believe
he was in Florida.
So, yeah, I was going to say a part of what I've written in this outline is just the official story. So really, I think there's very credible evidence that actually Dillinger himself was not in East Chicago when this bank robbery happened, because he was seen in Daytona Beach the day before. And by 1933 or 1934 road standards or highway standards, I'm not exactly sure how long a trip from Daytona Beach to East Chicago, Indiana would have been. But it would have been – Dillinger basically would have had to have driven all night, get there the next day to carry out this robbery. So it's very questionable that Dillinger was even at the East Chicago bank robbery. Now, John Hamilton was, because he's actually wounded there. Hamilton had not accompanied the gang to Daytona Beach. And so there's a very good chance that Dillinger was not even there. But nonetheless, witnesses placed him there. O'Malley is killed. And, you know, this becomes part of the Dillinger story that, you know, that Dillinger killed O'Malley and that he's, you know, he's charged for it in Lake County, Indiana.
Just for reference, YouTube, I'm showing the map, how long it would take for someone today to drive from Daytona Beach to East Chicago, Indiana, and it's 17 hours and 5 minutes. And that's with today's roads conditions. I would love to be able to.
And 24-hour gas stations. They didn't have that in those days.
Yeah, true, true. And the other thing is, too, you know, we talked about previously that the date of the last time he was saw, even if it was a day or two off, let's just even call it a week. Like, the, you know, it wasn't a week. Could they have done it in a week? That's a tough task to get up there in a week.
Yep.
I mean, although they did move around quick. We do know the Dillinger gang did move around quick. That was their MO. They were able to travel the whole country very quickly, robbing and moving and robbing and moving.
Yes. Yeah. But again, it's they didn't have that much gasoline. Again, they did stage their extra gasoline for these bank robberies, but it's going to be damned hard to stage, you know, gasoline from Florida to the very northern tip of Indiana.
There you go. I'm going to try to share my screen with pertinent information as we go along in this podcast, because I feel like if you're watching on YouTube or you're listening in your ears or your headphones, you know, don't do it while you're driving, please. But, you know, you can at least watch on YouTube and see. But I feel like it'll be a little bit extra. I would love to see what the weather was. If someone could, we could look up.
Yeah, good.
What
point,
the weather
because,
was?
Yeah, this is the, well. It's January 19. You know, it's January. So,
Christmas. It's Christmas.
Yeah, and so you know, obviously in Florida, the weather's probably good, but the further north you went, you could have snow, sleet, all kinds of road hazards that would slow you down. And again,
of mud roads.
And mud roads, because you don't have interstate highways.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So. Yeah. And the reason, and if you didn't realize, I guess, Todd, this one's for you. The reason we care so much on where he was is because one of the main things people always argue about John is that he was a murderer, right? He was a killer. But what we are saying is that this was the only time he's ever been really associated with it, and it was a charge that ultimately led to his, you know, basically being public enemy number one, was that he was charged with this murder and then became like essentially had evidence to be make him public enemy number one. But we care because if that's the case, it's another reason the FBI didn't do what they were supposed to do at the time and made him something he wasn't, which was he was a murderer, which we want the truth. Yeah, right, folks.
Yeah, just set the record straight. Let's just what really happened. That's what we want to know.
Definitely.
So when people say, well, he was a killer, you know, and all those Facebook groups and stuff, and I could see Travis and Mike getting all so mad. They're like, no, he wasn't. He wasn't.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, here's something funny. Just this week, I, in the scopes of my duties, I ran into an Ulster O'Malley descendant.
Get the hell out of here. Travis, you make shit up all the time.
No, man. I'm being serious. As me being on the law enforcement side and them not being on the law enforcement side, it was really interesting because I asked him, I said, O'Malley, that's a interesting name. I said, you wouldn't be related to the Oscar O'Malley that got killed in East Chicago during the Dillinger days. And he said, yes, he's a great, great nephew of O'Malley.
Yo, so you're telling me. Interesting. You met another great great nephew because you're a great nephew.
Yes.
Oh, that's crazy.
And now the Dillinger relative is in law enforcement, and the O'Malley relative is not.
Yeah.
Dillinger was charged with the murder. Okay, so we keep going. The gang then traveled to Tucson, Arizona, for another vacation. They sent the vacation a lot in 14 months.
Hey, if you're going to be a gangster, that's what it's all about. I mean, this is not a 9-to-5 job. I mean, I'm a gangster, so I could take really cool vacations
and wear nice suits.
Yeah, and look great. They were arrested, and Dillinger was returned to Crown Point, Indiana, and to stand trial for the murder of O'Malley. I love this part too because one, Tucson, Arizona has Dillinger Days.
Yeah.
Celebrating this. I think it was recently. I think it's in the spring or late winter, right when he was arrested in Tucson. They do like a whole Dillinger Days thing. So to this day, he's still kind of a figure out there. But then also, there were so many states that wanted his collar, right? They wanted him, right? They wanted to arrest him.
Yeah.
And Indiana jump through hoops to push through the warrant, or is, am I right saying that, guys?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously murder, you know, kind of is Trump's bank robbery, I guess.
Yes, okay, so, that's true. Yeah.
So the murder warrant was in Lake County, Indiana. But, you know, it's really one thing to, I'll just say this to the listeners that, you know, we can't really go into it now. It's a lot of detail, but go back and look at that arrest of the Dillinger gang in Tucson. Not a shot was fired. They got the entire gang with I think there was a little bit of a scuffle with involving Pierpont in his arrest, but it was amazing how they took the entire Dillinger gang down. It caught them just red-handed. And, you know, the FBI, and again, I was an FBI agent. I'm proud to have served, but I got to say the Tucson Police Department did one hell of a job in bringing the Dillinger gang down. The FBI had him cornered three times, and they got away. So
what I think is funny was actually the Tucson Fire Department who recognized them, other than law enforcement. So the fire department actually brought them down.
And we keep and hopefully we keep that that tradition going. Maybe we can go out to Tucson one year. Maybe we can be a part of that this year. Hell, there might be freaking buried treasure once we pull out this map.
Well, actually,
yep.
Joe, you're not far off the mark. Exactly. During the course of some of the Hollywood stuff that we were involved in, there was a letter that surfaced that was, I think, Travis, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was hidden in a wall at the hotel in Tucson. The Congress Hotel?
Yeah, the Congress Hotel, they were doing the renovations, and they found a letter from 1933 or 34 in the wall.
In the wall, and was sent to Indianapolis. The writing on it was just dead on for Dillinger's writing. Now, I don't think Dillinger actually stayed in the Congress Hotel, but the writing on it was dead on. So,
what's the letter saying? Where is the letter now?
We don't have the full letter. I never saw the full letter. I just saw bits and pieces of it. But I think, as far as I know, the hotel, I guess, still has it.
But there's an interesting fact about when John was caught out there. He was also in their FBI reports. He ate a piece of letter.
True.
He ate it and swallowed it. So.
Yep. And there were actually newspaper reports at the time too. That talked about that the Dillinger gang had buried money out in Tucson. Not specific. Unfortunately, the reports aren't specific. But so again, this talk of buried loot has been with the Dillinger gang from the start.
Todd and Stuart, I have a question for you guys real quick. So you guys are obviously retired from your former life, but are you guys private investigators now? Could you be considered that now? Like some of the work that you do outside of the podcasting and your regular, you know what I'm saying?
I guess we're both licensed private investigators.
That's what I wanted to know. Okay. Cause I didn't know that. And I know I'm in my head as a viewer, I'd be asking that too. Like, because we're going to be looking into this stuff, like where's the buried treasure and stuff. And like, as licensed private investigators, we want to give legitimacy to our podcast and to this developing podcast that we're doing, because you guys are legitimate. Like we're going to use tactics that we could go to court and essentially be able to prove our case.
You're exactly right.
Joe and Travis Thompson going around,
Joe, I'll speak for Todd for a second, and it may be something that he's never actually thought of, but as you go through, as you gain experience as an investigator, and Travis, same thing with you, no doubt. You know, when you work a case and you gather evidence, what you learn over time is that ultimately what you're gathering is going to be used in court. Okay. You may have to go to trial. You may have to testify to this. So as I worked any case, I always had in the back of my mind, is this going to be convincing at trial? Is this something that is relevant to my case? Is the chain of custody intact that will allow this to be entered in court?
Yeah, that chain of custody.
Yeah, admissible. So you learn as you go along that's how you look at any piece of evidence and anything as you go along. And that's exactly how I've looked at this case from the very beginning. For instance, the map that we referenced in episode one that we found on the Dillinger farm, that there has been a chain of custody maintained with that map from the very day we found it that exists to this day. So it's documented where it's been, who's handled it, what testing has been done on it. This is not something we're doing just as some haphazard, what is this kind of stuff? What are we doing here? We approach this as a real investigation as professionals, looking at this as if we have to prove this in court. Now, no one's going to jail behind anything that we're going to do, but as far as history goes, historically, we don't have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt as we would in criminal court. But I bet you Todd is the same way and Travis, you're the same way. Anything I approach, I think about, is this beyond a reasonable doubt? Will this work in court? So same process we're applying here.
Not me.
You would have to, because, if we prove history has changed, we've rewritten history, there's going to be a lot of naysayers. But if we show it that we've done it professionally, like an investigation, then I think the public will see it differently than like us on a reality TV show or something. Us doing this with passion and professionalism will show, the proof in the pudding.
Yep,
exactly.
And hence why we need to do this on ourselves, on our own, and not with Hollywood backing for any reason. We could probably show parts, 2% of the whole thing on a big, it would get publicity in Hollywood, but nobody's going to do an investigation like us.
No, especially
with your qualifications. Look, I'm the lowly former TV reporter host. My investigation, to be very clear, I was a fluff reporter. I was a morning show reporter.
You said you were a fluffer?
Yeah, there it is. The stuff that I did was very light in the morning, energy, jumping up on trampoline parks when they open in town. I did have my occasional, East Indianapolis shooting or fire. There's a bunch of true crime or live crime stuff that I did. Bleed at Leeds, kind of news, daily news stuff that I did in the morning. But most of my stuff was, so having you guys, I did in my own investigations on stuff, but it was never hard until I started Infamous Indie. And then I really dove into like true crime history, but I'm a history buff. So to have you guys here and legitimize what we're doing is only going to make this more fun. And plus you all have to teach me too, to make sure I don't, screw up the chain of command in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Well, that's one reason why I like that we have Todd and Stewart. I'm in law enforcement, but I also have the family aspect where I can be tainted into thinking a different direction. But I have two outsiders.
You are kind of very mindset. Biased. So,
yes. Yeah. Exactly. My biasm could, shift my thinking. So I'm really happy that we have Stewart and Todd on board with this investigation.
Thanks, guys. That was a good sidebar. I know we're in Tucson, Arizona right now after he got arrested and brought back to Crown Point. But I think that was a really good sidebar, because I'm glad we did that, because honestly, it just is so cool that you guys are here and we're going to do this so legitimately.
Yeah, just to clarify for those listeners maybe not familiar with Indiana, when we talk about Crown Point and Lake County and East Chicago, O'Malley, the First National Bank of East Chicago was in East Chicago, obviously. East Chicago is in Lake County. The county seat of Lake County is Crown Point. So any trials, that kind of thing, was held in Crown Point. So that's the connection. That's why Dillinger's in Crown Point.
Yep, Crown Point Jail in March 1933. Is that right? 1933 March?
Or 1934. No, it'd be 34. Yeah.
Okay,
if I put
cool.
33, that was wrong.
Yeah. And formed. Go ahead.
Let me just ask here. So Indiana was able to get him extradited from Arizona up there.
Yes. Okay. And Todd also, too, just let me interject real quick. The law enforcement officer that brings Dillinger back from Arizona is a guy named Matt Leach. Matt Leach was with the Indiana State Police, and he will also be a prominent figure in this tale after Dillinger is killed. Leach was involved in the investigation of Dillinger from the start. He was dogged in his pursuit of Dillinger. He was a little bit outshone, I guess, publicity-wise by the FBI. But Leach will have a very important part to play as far as some conspiracy or corruption allegations that surfaced after Dillinger died.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm trying to pull up a picture of Matt Leach because I've never seen a picture of him, and I really want to see if
John – well, John really liked having fun with that guy.
Is that him?
That's him. Yep. That's him.
Yep.
Yep. And so –
so, yeah, just, there you go, Matt Leach.
Just for the conspiracy folks out there, there's actually, like I said, we'll go in-depth about what Leach found after the killing of Dillinger, but – he later wrote a manuscript about Dillinger and the pursuit of Dillinger and that investigation and some things. Had traveled somewhere to present the manuscript to a publisher, and mysteriously was killed in a single car crash, and the manuscript was never found.
Here's the state police website too. The manuscript was never found.
Yeah.
Yep, never found.
You think it was buried?
I'd love to. I don't know, but I'd love to read that, man.
Oh, my God. It was
also an interesting, weird thing about the state police is John's brother, Hubert, which you guys will find out during our investigation, how much involvement he had with the gang. But he later went on to work for the state police as a mechanic and retired from the state police as a mechanic.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Which I don't know why they hired him.
Okay, let's keep going. Guys, we're running out of time for this episode, which is great. This is pretty good stuff. He's at Crown Point Jail in 1934, formed a new gang with Babyface Nelson, Homer Van Meter, and John Hamilton. Was Hamilton part of the old gang?
Hamilton was part of the original gang. I think Hamilton was really a mentor and advisor that Dillinger actually looked up to.
They had a few successful robberies in 1934 and took some time off in St. Paul. During their stay in St. Paul, their landlady became suspicious and called the FBI. When the Bureau responded, there was a brief shootout, but all the gang members got away, although Dillinger was wounded in the leg. Dillinger and girlfriend Billy Frechette made their way to the Dillinger family farm in Mooresville during the weekend of April 6th to 8th in 1934, right under the surveillance of the FBI. Billy was later arrested in Chicago and depressed Dillinger went for a vacation to a lodge in Upper Wisconsin known as Little Bohemia. The FBI later tracked them to Little Bohemia, and after a shootout that left an innocent civilian dead, the entire Dillinger gang got away. Didn't the FBI kill that civilian?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure that's
so
right.
What happened is, the Bureau had intelligence that the Dillinger gang was at Little Bohemia, that they were about to leave, that their departure was imminent. So when they finally get there, it's probably 11 o'clock midnight or so. They're disoriented. They ride up, and just as they ride up, they don't have time to surround the building as normal would be normal procedure. Some guys are coming out of the bar, and there's a call for them to halt. They get in a car. These three guys get in a car. They're starting to leave. The Bureau says halt. They don't stop, and they opened up and smoked them. And one of the three was killed. Turns out just a complete innocent, uninvolved person who was drinking at the bar. And of course, this gunfire then alerts the Dillinger gang, who returned. Babyface Nelson returned fire somewhat. The rest of the gang just ran out the back and got away. So the Bureau, thinking that the gang is trapped there, just sat there all night, thinking, "Oh, we've got them trapped."
And, yeah, but they left the ladies behind.
They left the ladies behind. So
there were women with them. And
yeah, so the FBI behind. Had the ladies trapped, but the gang had gotten away.
Interesting. I mean, it's just crazy how much luck and also how much, because that's pure luck that those civilians were coming out of the bar right at that moment to the point where it stopped the FBI from doing their job, which is surrounding the building.
And I'll just tell you a very interesting story for me that
don't do that, Stuart. We don't want to hear you tell another interesting story.
Well, I this was a personal experience that was very, very weird.
Okay, so, fine. You can tell.
In 2021, and Travis was involved in this, and we were part of an episode of Expedition Unknown on the Discovery Channel, and it somewhat highlighted the map. It didn't go into near the detail that we're going to go into, but we actually filmed a sequence or a segment of the episode at Little Bohemia. It's in far upper northern Wisconsin. It's a beautiful place. I recommend anybody going there. There's a nice restaurant there. It's very virtually unchanged from 1934 when the Dillinger Gang was there. And so after we had wrapped actually filming one night up there, and we all had a few drinks in the same bar where Dillinger would have been, and had an early morning the next day. And so I was going to leave, and so I you know was leaving the bar by myself. I walked out the door, and
someone yelled halt.
Well, the FBI pulled up.
Not quite. But it was the weirdest feeling that I had actually been transported back in time, because I walked out the very same door that these civilians would have walked out of, facing the woods that where the FBI would have been. And I swear for about a second or two, I was transported back in time, and I was in 1934, and it's like the FBI's right out there in front of me. It was the weirdest experience of my life, it happened. I can't deny it.
Did you get to talk to Melvin, the FBI agent?
No.
So no one talked to you.
But the woods where Melvin was were right in front of me. It was the weirdest thing.
That's very interesting.
Did you hear gunshots?
No gunshots, but it's almost like they were just about to happen. It was the weirdest experience of my life,
dude. There's something to say. I mean, I'm paranormally challenged. Things don't happen to me paranormally wise, like ghosts and talking. But there's something to be said about feelings and being part of like history and walking and touching and. Yeah.
I'm like you, Joe. I think we've talked about that before, because we were in a haunted place, a supposedly haunted place
at the same
time. And we both said, I've never experienced anything like this. But and it wasn't like a haunting. It was just more like for that brief moment, I was in 1934.
And I
just can't explain it any other way. It was so weird.
Sure. You know, that's so interesting. I've never heard you tell that story.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we found the map a few days prior to us finding the map, I had that dream about John walking through this mist and pointing at the ground where we found the map.
Yeah.
I thought that was extremely weird. Yeah. That it's like our past is reaching out to tell us something.
Exactly.
Heroes.
We've said from the start, Travis, that there is something to this, that there's more than meets the eye on this case. It's inexplicable to me. But it's there. There's no question that there is something to this.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Can I pull up another picture real quick of Little Bohemia? Let's
please.
Yeah, let's go see. Ahead, shoot.
Is this the bar? God, that's such a small picture. I'm sorry, everybody.
That's tiny. I got to put on the readers. It looks like. yes. So if you look all the way to the left.
Yeah.
Okay. That was the door I came out of. That's actually where the bar is. The door that's in the middle, it leads to the restaurant, but the bar is all the way over to the left.
I can't zoom. I really want to zoom in. I'm trying to zoom in and I'm just having trouble here. Okay, get there. Okay, we're kind of going.
I would love for all of us to go there.
Oh, it's a beautiful place. It really is. It sits on a lake. In fact, the Dillinger gang got out and they ran around this lake and they got away in various ways. But man, it was just such an experience and really cool.
So we're doing great, but also running out of time. So we're going to keep going here. Dillinger, You said after Little Bohemia, Dillinger and Van Meter had plastic surgery to alter their fingerprints and facial features. One of the more important facts for our investigations for this conspiracy, because a lot of people are like, well, he had plastic surgery and stuff. He altered his fingerprints. So, of course, the guy on the table on the autopsy after the Biograph was not, you know, wasn't matching up with John Dillinger's history. So,
well, no, yeah, there were some features, physical features of it that didn't match. But at least according to the prints that were taken of the corpse, the fingerprints had been altered on that fingerprint of the corpse. Now, that said, believe it or not, that was not an uncommon thing at the time. There were several criminals that tried to, thinking that if I had my fingerprints altered or eradicated, they won't be able to identify me. So it was not an unheard of thing at the time to have your fingerprints mutilated with acid, which was the description of the process was just sounded like unbelievable pain.
Yeah, that does. I mean, we'll go into the changes. And when we go into your, because we're going to get a real in-depth look, and we're going to give our listeners a real in-depth look of what your report says, and that has a lot in it. So anyway, shortly after after that, Dillinger began staying with Anna Sage, and he had a girlfriend named Polly Hamilton. He was going by the name Jimmy Lawrence. Sage, who was facing deportation, turned Dillinger into the FBI, who later tracked and killed him at the Biograph Theater in Chicago. There were several discrepancies between the features of the dead man and Dillinger, and his father and sister didn't initially believe it was him. Dillinger's father had him buried under a slab of concrete to avoid someone digging him up.
We
should probably dig him up, though.
Yeah. So again, all of that information is what I would call the official story. As we go through this podcast, a lot of those things we can pick apart, and we'll tell you the alternate side of that story. But yeah, that's the official part of the story.
And then almost immediately after Dillinger's death, the FBI received information that he was still alive. The Bureau maintained that Dillinger had been positively identified through fingerprints. And during the course of the Dillinger gang bank robberies, approximately $200,000 in negotiable bonds were stolen and never recovered. The Bureau documented efforts to find it was unsuccessful.
Yep. So, at least 200,000. Yeah. 200,000 is unaccounted for out there.
And when you say bond, what did you call it? Non-negotiable bonds or?
No. Negotiable bonds. Negotiable. So that means basically it's not a bond that's issued to somebody, in their name. Anybody can show up and negotiate this bond. And in fact, some of the bonds.
So it's cash or not cash?
It's not cash. It's a bond, drawn on a particular bank, and probably none of those banks exist anymore. But some of those bonds were actually negotiated after the fact. They were never able to be traced to anyone. So there, and I say after the fact, I mean after Dillinger died, some of those bonds surfaced that someone had negotiated.
I'm interested to see. So, honestly, I was under the impression it was always cash.
No, it's not cash. It was right? Bonds.
I mean, when you go to a bank, don't you think you're here for the bank's money, but it's just negotiable bonds. So what would they do? Would they go and sell those bonds or like use those bonds for money?
Well, again, it was one of the things that's why they had so much of it, because they at the time, if you're a gangster on the run, it doesn't do you a lot of good. I don't know what the I don't necessarily know what the procedure in 1933 or 1934 was for,
negotiating the bond.
did you have to show some kind of ID? Probably not, because times were simpler in those days. But again, it wasn't easy you couldn't just walk into a store and give them a bond, as you could cash.
That's what I'm saying. And you're saying, and it makes more sense. Actually, I think, let me get this right, because then we're going to stop this episode because we're running out of time. But essentially, they used all the cash and they had these bonds kind of left over, and so that's what's hidden.
Yeah, well, they knew that the bonds had value, so they're not going to just throw them away or, you know, not take them. So they had them, you know, and I guess with the thought we can use them at some point. But it certainly wasn't as easy to use as cash.
You guys know, like, if like we go through this, like, I want one. Not just not for the money, but for like just the pure fact that would be so dope to have one of the one of the.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay. Guys, great job. How do you guys feel? Good? We all love it. Caught up on our history?
Ready for number three.
Cool, cool.
Oh, yes.
We really appreciate y'all listening. We're going to be continuing this history-breaking podcast, developing true crime. I mean, it's incredible. Any last words before we say goodnight for this episode?
Send those questions and comments in. We love it.
Definitely. Subscribe, share. Get us out there. Join the investigation.
Sounds good. Leave comments.
If there's anything that you guys think we missed or want to talk about, let's do it. All right. Thanks, everybody. The Digging Up Dillinger podcast is produced by Joe Melillo and Grace Hiles. Theme music produced by Eddie Bandis. Follow us on TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube. Until next time, keep digging.